court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. I see the United States in this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument is United States versus Frith. Mr. Handelsman.
May it please the court, Robert Handelsman for the appellant. The issues raised in oral argument are in the same sequence as they are raised in the briefs. I will rest on the briefs for arguments one and two. There are two key facts which govern the issues on this appeal. First is that Frith was convicted of criminal conduct which occurred on only one day, September 30, 97, even though similar conduct occurred between May 96 and December 97. And second, most of the losses would have been incurred if CPB shut down the day before September 30, 97. Argument three has three parts. First is that restitution cannot be imposed because there is no evidence that any losses were sustained as a result of the conduct alleged in the counts of conviction. Most of the losses would have been incurred if CPB shut down on September 29, 97, the day before the criminal conduct occurred. Therefore, there is no evidence that any losses were incurred solely as a result of the conduct alleged in the counts of conviction. The second issue raised in Argument 3 is that the statutes which provide the basis for the counts of conviction do not contain the word scheme, and the counts of conviction do not allege a scheme. They refer only to conduct on one day. The law from the Supreme Court in this circuit, the Huey and Murray cases, is emphatic that restitution is limited to losses caused by the offense conduct and cannot be based on relevant conduct. The government's contention here of a scheme is based on relevant conduct, conduct of which Frith was not convicted and which occurred at times other than September 30th, 97. Again, there is no evidence that any losses were sustained because of the conduct alleged in the counts of conviction. And I would submit to you that these rules of law require you to reverse outright the restitution obligation. And the third part of Argument 3 is that there is evidence that Frith put more money into CPB than he took out. Judge Pallmeyer did not make any findings of fact on this issue, and this court is not equipped to make those findings. It is up to Judge Pallmeyer to decide if Frith put more money in the CPB than he took out, or if the government's contentions in opposition are meritorious. This is not the place to argue this issue, and it should be remanded back to Judge Pallmeyer to make the necessary findings, and then we'll see where we go from there. Argument 4 attacks specific components of the restitution order. The first is the failure to give Frith credit for some $360,000 in CPB assets, which were apparently applied to administrative expenses and not to paying customers back. The government's principal response to this contention is that Frith did not object to this allocation in the liquidation proceedings, and the government cites the Scott case to you. There is no requirement that Frith object to the allocation in a liquidation proceeding to preserve his objection to this element in restitution, and Scott has nothing to do with this case because that case concerned audit expenses. And the government has not shown that any part of that $360,000 went to audit expenses, as was the case in Scott. I also point out that Argument 4A of the initial brief cites a Fifth Circuit case that administrative expenses and these types of matters, I think that case involved bankruptcy trustees, are not subject to restitution. The other part of Argument 4 concerns the accountant's malpractice carrier. Reimbursement of the accountant's malpractice carrier. The accountant's malpractice carrier paid the liquidator not because of Frith's negligence, Frith's wrongdoing, but because of the accountant's negligence. There is no provision in the statute for restitution because of third-party negligence, which is what we are basically dealing with here on this issue. The reply brief gives...
I didn't understand your argument about the relevant conduct. What sense does that make?
It's a foil to the government's contention.
I don't understand. I mean, what is the sense of it? So you have the government, you have a scheme here, and the government focuses on one, you know, what it calls a snapshot of the scheme. But why can't it look at the full losses inflicted by the scheme, even if it only charged a bit of it? I don't understand.
Because the laws that exist today, the only thing you can consider in restitution is losses caused by the offense of conviction. The offense of conviction occurred on one day.
Why do you say that?
Because that's what the indictment said. The indictment.
No. Why do you say that the law, the restitution, is limited that fashion?
Because that's what the Supreme Court said in Huey, and that's what you've said in Murray. Restitution cannot be based on relevant conduct. Can it be based on a
Why
scheme?
Why not? Is there a reason for that?
Well, that restitution cannot be based
right.
on relevant conduct?
Yeah.
I think the brief cites the Randall case. That it has
not
to
a
be
case, a reason. How about a reason, right? Law is supposed to make sense.
Well.
Does it, or is it just
well,
garbage?
Maybe from the government's perspective in this case it doesn't make sense. From the defendant's, it does.
What sense does it make? That's what I keep asking you.
I don't know how to answer what sense it makes. The law is the restitution cannot be based on...
Some senseless decision by the Supreme Court. Is what you're saying?
Well, I think Murray is the same thing. Restitution has to be based on the offense of conviction. Losses caused by the offense conduct. And it has not been proven here that the offense conduct caused any losses. That is the conduct on September 30th, 97. As I said before, the statutes which create the basis for prosecution here, Title 15, say nothing about a scheme. The two counts on which Frith was convicted did not allege a scheme. And I would submit to you that is the only thing you can look at, the offense conduct. What occurred on September 30th, 97?
What were the facts in Huey?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
Or Murray?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
So how can we know whether those cases are intended to apply in the circumstances of this case?
Because they cite a hard and fast concrete rule.
They cite a rule?
They state a hard and fast concrete rule that restitution the losses on which restitution is based is limited to conduct caused by the offense conduct. Losses caused by the offense conduct. No ifs, ands, buts, or maybes about it. No exceptions. It's a hard and fast rule. That is all that you or the district court can look at when deciding restitution issues. What losses were caused by the conduct for which the defendant was convicted? Getting back to argument 4B. The reply brief gives an example.
Well, are we under the Victim and Witness Protection Act here or the mandatory?
The mandatory. Mandatory. The MVRA.
But was that the subject of Huey?
No, it wasn't.
Well, did you have a problem there?
No, I don't think so, because you have Murray cases, and I believe...
Well, look, it's fine to have Murray, but you relied on Huey. And Huey is about a different statute. So now you're limited to Murray.
Well, the way the MVRA... I think Huey may have involved a scheme. And the amendments to the VWRA, as I recall when I was reading the cases about a scheme, were intended to... were a legislative overruling of Huey in that respect. Only in that respect. Said nothing about using relevant conduct to base restitution. I mean, you've had cases here. The Randall case is the one that pops out in my mind. Says that the restitution is limited to losses caused by the offense conduct and nothing else. Now, getting back to argument 4B, the reply brief gives an example of an embezzling bank employee. He must pay restitution to the bank's bonding company, but he need not pay restitution to the malpractice carrier for the bank's accountant because the accountant didn't catch the embezzlement. That's essentially what we're dealing with here. Argument 5 is an extension of argument 4. If you accept the contentions in 4, Frith's offense level must be reduced by 1, because the amount of actual loss must be the same for restitution and the offense level.
Does he have any money to pay restitution?
After all this is over, I tend to doubt it, but...
Well, you're appointed, aren't you?
Yes.
So he doesn't have any money, does he?
Well, I was appointed. I don't know what his bank account holds.
Well, I don't understand. You can't be appointed unless he's indigent, well, can you?
Well, he had appointed counsel down below.
Well, he couldn't have appointed counsel if he wasn't indigent.
Well, I assume he doesn't have enough to pay a...
Well, if he doesn't have enough to pay a lawyer, does he have enough to pay several million dollars in restitution?
Well, not at the current time, obviously.
But he has expectations, does he?
I don't know what's going to happen with him.
A lot of money in prison?
When he gets out. I mean, he could have an inheritance after he gets out. He could win the lottery. If I could predict the future, I wouldn't be here right now. But one thought I'd like to leave you with is that restitution must be based on the offense conduct, and it is limited to the offense conduct.
Do the sentencing guidelines play any part in your analysis?
Of the restitution?
Yeah.
No, it's strictly a case law issue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanselman.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Levin?
May it please the Court, my name is Joel Levin. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney here in Chicago in the Northern District of Illinois. I will not address the arguments 1 and 2 in the appellant's brief, since he did not address them today. They concern the guideline calculation. Unless the Court has any questions concerning that, I will go to argument 3 in the appellant's brief. And I think the problem here is we do not dispute the contention that the restitution must be based on the conduct that is charged and convicted in the offense of conviction. We do not dispute that proposition. I think the problem with the appellant's analysis is failing to analyze what that offense conduct was. It's really not discussed in their brief, nor was it discussed today in oral argument. The offenses of conviction in counts 18 and 19 concerned operating this brokerage, CPB, Chicago Partnership Board, in violation of the net capital and the special reserve requirements on that day, September 30th, 1997. Now, those requirements, as established at trial, the special reserve requirement and the net capital requirement, are the protections that are given to customers of the firm in order that when the day comes that they're to get their money back, that the money is there. The evidence at trial established that Frith, beginning in approximately May of 1996, was violating both the special reserve and the net capital requirements. Essentially, the firm was insolvent for approximately a year and a half. September 30th was the day that was charged in those counts. But that's not to say that
I don't understand. Why do you charge a single day?
Well,
what is the sense of that?
We charged a single day because we were able to establish on that specific day what his special reserve, what he was contending his special reserve was and what it actually was. We were able to pin it down on that day because on that day he submitted the focus report for that quarter, and he had an amount that was provided.
How does the operation of this company in violation of these requirements on one day cause injury? I don't get that.
It causes injury because essentially by allowing the firm to continue by submitting the focus report for that quarter and then thereby allowing the firm to remain open.
Suppose the firm had, as Mr. Handelsman said, suppose it had closed the day before. Wouldn't the damages be the same?
They very well may have been.
His operation on September 30th rather than September 29th a cause of loss?
Well, I think we could have charged any day.
Charging a day. The conduct that caused the injury extended over the period, you know, when he was collecting money from these people, and or when the loss is actually incurred. What does September 30th have to do with anything?
Well, as I indicated, the significance of that day is that was the day of the last quarterly report that he submitted.
If you want to charge a violation on one day, that's fine, but you're not going to get... I don't say you get restitution for damage, for losses that were caused before and after.
Well, when the firm folded, the firm ultimately folded on December 4th, and because it had evolved essentially into a Ponzi scheme whereby the last in the door were the ones who weren't able to get a recovery. So in a sense, once he had built up the firm to a point where it was insolvent to the point of $3 million, and once he submitted the forms that he needed to submit to keep this firm open, by keeping the firm open and by keeping the money coming in for that last quarter, he did cause the loss to the last people who were in the door.
Well, is that what your restitution is based on?
The restitution is based solely on the loss to customers. The loss...
People who joined the scheme after September 30th?
We did not. The district court record does not reflect that every customer...
Well, that's kind of critical, right?
Well, once again, the loss to the customers was as of December 4th, and we can establish
most of those people probably were their losses were inflicted before then.
Well, I would take issue with that in the sense that the people who, although the record does not pin down the time frame as to when a customer came in.
If someone deposited money in August and then lost it in December, nothing that happened on September 30th affected his situation.
If that person was still out money on December 4th, if they had previously submitted it prior to September 30th, I grant you that would be the case, but to the extent that we can come up with the best possible approximation of what the loss is on December 4th, it is in the record. It's at least in terms of customers.
But it wasn't inflicted on September 30th. I don't understand you. I don't know why you charge one day, but if you do charge one day, it seems to me it limits the restitution you can obtain.
Well, I would agree with that. If it's in the nature, say, of one specific false statement or one discrete act, but the nature of this offense is operating a business, keeping the doors open of a business.
Why don't you charge? Look, the offense stretched over many months. Why'd you pick one day? Some reason for that?
Well, the only reason...
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, once again, as I look back on our charging decision, the reason that I recall that we used was because that was the day the focus report was due, so that was the day we could determine with precision what the deficiency was in the special reserve account as well as the net capital. And that was the rationale in charging it one day. But the fact that it's charged in one day, once again, the nature of the conduct is keeping the business open, keeping it running.
Why didn't you charge him with mail fraud or wire fraud? That's his offense.
Those were certainly considerations, but given the nature that it was a securities-related offense, we charged it in the way that we did. That is,
he made a big mistake. Also, I don't understand this inclusion of this amount for this insurance company that was lost money. I don't understand that. Isn't that the kind of consequential damages we say in the cases that you can't get in criminal restitution?
Well, once again, in our brief, we rely on the statutory section, which is 3664I, I think, that indicates that if a third-party insurance carrier contributes, it's 3664J1, where an insurance carrier contributes to the payment of the loss, then restitution is to be ordered for that insurance carrier. So it's a statutory issue.
No, I understand that, but you're claiming, aren't you, that there was negligence on the part of an accounting firm, wasn't it?
I think that is their assertion that the accounting firm was negligent.
Right.
The accountant came in and did his annual audit every year. The problem was the accountant was not told by Frith what was going on, and he didn't discover it. So there was an issue as to whether he should have discovered it, but we don't believe
that. If he should have discovered it, he was negligent. And if his negligence contributed to the loss to the insurance company, then those would be consequential damages, right? The scheme precipitates the negligence, which causes a loss, and the cases say you can't get that.
Well, absent the statute, that might be the case, but where the statutory provision specifically says that when an insurance carrier contributes to the victim, which occurred in this case, the victim being the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, they received $190,000 from this insurance carrier. Under that specific statutory provision, restitution is to be made to that insurance carrier. So granted, it might be different if there wasn't that section, but given the section, it's our position that the restitution was appropriate to the insurance carrier. With respect to the other arguments that counsel has made, he has indicated that Mr. Frith put more money in than he took out, essentially that there is no loss whatsoever. The problem with that is Mr. Frith himself admitted during the trial testimony that he still owed the entire money of the broker-dealer liability assumption agreements. In other words, he admitted during the course of the trial that he owed $3 million. He also stipulated to a judgment. So I don't think that was really a meaningful argument that was either advanced before the district court or of course, Judge Pallmeyer was aware of the figures and was aware of what his schedule showed, but he did not in any sense repay the money that he had taken out. The facts, especially his admission, established that he clearly had not repaid the money.
Do you anticipate there will be recovery of the restitution ordered?
Well, of course, he's serving a lengthy prison term. However, he's a very bright, articulate, driven individual. And so this is the type of situation where once this man gets out of prison, I think he's talented enough and bright enough where he may well be able to make a dent, at least in the restitution. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mr. Halesman, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Thank you. Government is essentially, what the government's position is, that they can build a restitution around the charging decision. I would agree with what Judge Posner said when I was working on this. I was wondering, why didn't they charge him with mail or wire fraud? We wouldn't have most of these issues if they did. But they didn't. They charged him with conduct on one day, and the law is very clear. A jury, of course, couldn't reach a verdict on the similar counts, 1 through 17, which allege basically the same conduct as 18 and 19. No matter how it might look to us logically, the law is law. Restitution is limited to losses caused by the offense conduct. And the government did not prove any losses due due solely to the filing of that report.
Is the record, the state of the record, such that there could be a quantification of the loss from September 30th going forward, or is it not possible based on what's in the record now?
As I recall it, you've probably seen the record more recently than I have. As I recall, they just did the calculations as I think Mr. Levin said, when the scheme was broken up. And I imagine an accountant could get a hold of the figures and do something, but as a record exists right now, I don't think it's there's a figure there. As far as the insurance payment, this isn't the type of insurance carrier that the statute intended to reimburse. I mentioned before, it's in the reply brief, the example of the bank embezzlement. The defendant bank employee who embezzles has to pay the bank's bonding company, but he doesn't have to pay back the insurer, the accountant, who didn't catch the embezzlement. And the comment about Mr. Frist's admissions during the course of the trial, that's an admission that has to be considered in light of the figures. There is a defense summary 6, I believe it's part of the appendix, which shows the money that was put in. This is something that Judge Ballmeyer would have to sort out and remand. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Hansman. And you were appointed, as we know, so we thank you for your efforts.
Thank you.
Your client.